You're listening to English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, number 34. This is English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, number 34. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in the beautiful city of Los Angeles, California. Remember to visit our new website and take a look at the learning guide for today's podcast, which has a complete transcript of the podcast, along with the definitions and additional information. In today's guide, we include some tips on improving your pronunciation, which you'll want to read. Go to www.eslpod.com for more information. On today's cafe, we're going to talk about news anchors, who they are and what they do. We are also going to go over what public schools teach and where they get their curriculum from. And as usual, we'll answer a few of your questions. Now let's get started. I was watching the news last night, and I like to flip between channels. To flip, F-L-I-P, means to change the channel on the television. Of course, you can do that real easily now because we have remote controls. We sometimes just call them the remote, R-E-M-O-T-E. That's the thing that you can hold in your hand and press a button to change the channels or to increase or decrease the volume. Well, I was flipping through the channels last night when the national news broadcasts were on. These are half-hour programs. There are three of them on three different television channels or television networks. And I noticed that some of them have different news anchors on their programs. So I thought it would be interesting to talk a little bit about famous news anchors in the United States. First of all, a news anchor, A-N-C-H-O-R, is the person who reads the news, the main person who or people who read the news on the news broadcast. We call those the anchor or anchors, if there are more than one. An anchor is a word that is also used for the thing that you, if you are on a boat, you drop it into the water. It's very heavy. It goes down to the bottom of the lake, for example, and it keeps you steady. The boat doesn't move because there is an anchor that is holding it there. We also use that word as a verb. To anchor something can also mean sort of to control. And this is the closer meaning when we talk about a news anchor being the person who controls or is the main person in the news program, what we would call the newscast, N-E-W-S-C-A-S-T, the newscast, all one word. Well, for many years in the United States, the news anchor was a man, usually a white man, and an older white man. So there would be a journalist, a reporter, would become the anchor. The reporter, of course, is the person who goes out and talks to people. And on a news broadcast, usually there are reporters in different parts of the city or the country or the world, and they film them talking about the problem. Well, usually one of those reporters, after many years, can become a news anchor. And traditionally, the anchors, as I say, were always white men, usually older white men. The most famous news anchor in the United States, at least in the 20th century, was probably a man called Walter Cronkite. Cronkite, C-R-O-N-K-I-T-E, I think. And Walter Cronkite is a name that every American knows because he was the news anchor for many years on one of the big television networks. There used to be just three big television chains of stations or networks, ABC, NBC, and the oldest is CBS. And those are abbreviations for, I think, the American Broadcast Company, the National Broadcast Company, and Columbia Broadcast Company. Anyway, Walter Cronkite was the anchor on the CBS Evening News. And so his name is very famous because everyone knows him. And he retired, he left his job maybe 10, 15, maybe longer years ago. But most people still know who he is. He's still alive. And he was very well respected. He was sort of like an older uncle who would talk to people in the newscast. People felt a lot of confidence in him. Well, in the last 20 years or so, things have been changing, but very slowly. Most of the news anchors for the three big network newscasts are still white, and they're mostly still men, but that is changing. In fact, there is now going to be a woman who is going to be the news anchor on the CBS Evening News. After Walter Cronkite left, there was another news anchor, another man, Dan Rather, and he left last year, and now the new news anchor will be a woman. And for the first time, there'll be a woman as the news anchor on CBS Evening News. So that's sort of a change. One of the other news stations also has a anchor who is female. The ABC newscast has two people. One of them is a woman. Elizabeth Vargas, I think, is her name. Sometimes you will see the word anchor man or anchor woman as one word. And that, of course, is just the same as an anchor, or you could say anchor person, I guess. You know that in American English, many of the old words that had man in it to represent men and women, many of them have been changed to person. So, for example, a spokesman, S-P-O-K-E-S-M-A-N, is a person who talks for an organization, who represents an organization with the newspapers and television shows. The White House, President Bush has a spokesperson, a spokesman. But we don't usually say spokesman anymore unless we know it's just a man. Now people will say spokesperson so that you can use that word for both a man and a woman. Many people don't like that change that has taken place in English in the last 30 years, where we no longer use the word man to represent both men and women. Some people think we should just leave it, but most people nowadays will say person instead of man. So another example would be chairperson, C-H-A-I-R, person. It used to be you would just say chairman or the chair. But now people often say chairperson, especially if you don't know who is that person, if they are a man or a woman. If you know, then you can say chairman, or if you know it's a woman, you can say chairperson. So anchorman has been kind of changed now to anchor person or just anchor. Our next topic is talking again a little bit about schools in the United States. Public schools in the United States, as some of you may know, are very different than the system of schools in other countries. First, I should point out, I should tell you that the word public, P-U-B-L-I-C, school, means something different in Great Britain, in England, than it does here in the United States. In the United States, a public school is a school that the government operates, the government runs. They are in control. In England, the term public school refers to a private, what we would call here in the United States, a private school, a non-government organization runs or operates the school. But here in the U.S., a public school is a government school. And when I say a government school, I mean the local or city government is usually the one who operates or runs the schools. American schooling is very decentralized compared to other countries. Decentralized, well, first of all, central means all in one place, in one area. Centralize is a verb, which means that you put things in one place. To decentralize is the opposite, that things are put in different places. In this case, the power or authority is in different places. And American schools are not all the same. The federal government, the national government, does not control the schools directly, and they don't control the curriculum. And the curriculum in a school, C-U-R-R-I-C-U-L-U-M, the curriculum is what the teachers teach, what they teach in history class, in math class, in science class, the actual lessons, the actual information. That's the curriculum. Well, unlike in many countries, there's one national curriculum, and everyone in the country studies the same books at the same grades. That's not the way it is in the United States. Every little city has its own, what we call a school district, D-I-S-T-R-I-C-T, and that's the government organization, the part of the government that takes care of the schools. And usually there are a group of people, what we would call a board, B-O-A-R-D. That's a group of people who run something, who organize something. In a company, you have the board of directors. Those are the 10 or 15 or 20 people who are the main leaders of the company. In a school district, you have the school board, and the school board is usually 5 to 10 people who are elected, and people vote for them, and they run the school. And they have, in most cases, a lot of freedom to decide what they want to teach in their schools. The states have a lot of influence. So the state of California, for example, has certain regulations and rules. But there is still a lot of freedom in the school district itself. So there is no national curriculum in American education. There are some people who want a federally mandated curriculum. Federal, F-E-D-E-R-A-L, means national, of course. A mandated curriculum, M-A-N-D-A-T-E-D, is one that is to mandate as a verb, means to order, to require someone to do something. So a federally mandated curriculum would be the government saying to all the federal government, the national government, they would say to all the individual schools, here's what you have to teach. Here are the textbooks that you have to use. The books that you use in the school are called textbooks. There is no federally mandated curriculum. There are what are called standards, S-T-A-N-D-A-R-D-S. Most states have a standards, set of standards, and these are things that students should know when they finish each grade. But there isn't a list of books that schools have to use. Now, you may be thinking, well, how do we know if everyone is learning the same thing in different schools? And there have been some people who have asked that question here. And one of the results is that many states now have an exam, a state exam. So everyone in that state has to take an exam, usually in high school. And these are called high school exit exams. To exit, E-X-I-T, means, you know, to leave, to go out. So in the high school exit exam, this is an exam that you have to pass if you are going to graduate from high school. This is a fairly new thing. When I was in high school, there was no high school exit exam. I probably would have failed it if there had been. But a high school exit exam is now required in many states, including here in California. And this is a new thing that has begun in the last maybe 5 or 10 years. So it will be very interesting to see what that does. Now, the school districts only control, the local school districts control usually from kindergarten, the very first level of school, which usually begins at age 5, all the way up to high school, grade 12. That's what we sometimes refer to as K-12 and K hyphen the letter K hyphen 12, the number, refers to elementary school, junior high, and senior high, or elementary school and high school, all the way up to grade 12. The colleges have a separate, the government colleges have a separate board, separate people who operate or run those schools, and those are almost always appointed, not elected. To appoint, A-P-P-O-I-N-T, means that someone says you will be part of the board and there's no election. People don't vote for it. Most colleges and universities, maybe all of the colleges and universities that are public in the United States, have appointed boards. In talking about education, I always think about a famous quote from Mark Twain. Mark Twain, T-W-A-I-N is his last name, you might know as a famous American writer from the 19th century, from the 1800s. He was the author of one of the most famous novels in English, Huckleberry Finn. He was also what we would call a humorist, H-U-M-O-R-I-S-T, someone who writes funny things. And one of his quotes was that, "I have never let my schooling interfere with my education." Well, to interfere, I-N-T-E-R-F-E-R-E, means to get in the way of, to stop you from doing something. Schooling is a noun here, means going to school. So what he's saying is, I never let going to school get in the way of me actually learning something. Meaning, of course, that schools sometimes don't necessarily teach us all that we need to know. Well, speaking of teaching, let's answer a few of your questions. Our first question comes from Guilherme. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Guilherme in Brazil. And the question is a simple one. What's the difference between a dictionary and a thesaurus? Well, a dictionary, you know, is a place, a book, rather, that has words and definitions. A thesaurus, T-H-E-S-A-U-R-U-S, a thesaurus is a book of synonyms. And synonyms, S-Y-N-O-N-Y-M, are words that have a similar or same meaning. The part of the word nym, N-Y-M, means the same as a name, so a synonym or a noun. So a synonym is a similar noun or a similar word. And that's what you will find in a thesaurus. You can look up certain words, certain ideas, certain concepts, and find similar words for them. And this is sometimes very useful when you are writing. In English writing, you may know that people like to have variety in the vocabulary that they use. This is true in many languages, maybe most languages, that good writing is considered to have different types of vocabulary you use. So sometimes writers will use a thesaurus to try to think of a different word to express the same idea. So, for example, instead of saying he was great, he was very good, you might see in a thesaurus he was fantastic, he was superb, he was stupendous. These are all words that mean the same as great. And usually they are less common words, and so that's also something that people may look for in good writing. So a thesaurus can be very useful for that. As I said, a thesaurus is a book full of synonyms. Sometimes you will often find in a thesaurus what are called antonyms, A-N-T-O-N-Y-M. An antonym, you can guess, is the opposite of a word. So the opposite of good is bad. You'll find words that mean the opposite. And finally, there are things that we call homonyms. And these are very common in English. There are some languages where you do not have many homonyms, but in English, there are many. And a homonym, H-O-M-O-N-Y-M, is when you have two words that have the same pronunciation but different meanings. So, for example, the words two, T-O, two, T-W-O, and two, T-O-O. Those are all pronounced the same, but they have different spellings and different meanings. So that would be an example of a homonym. That first part of that word, H-O-M-O, means the same. So whenever you see that in a word, it usually means part of the word is going to be the same or mean the same. Our next question comes from Jola, J-O-L-A, in Warsaw, Poland. The question has to do with abbreviated words such as rehab, lab, mag, celeb. These are all short forms, informal, I should say, short forms for longer words. Rehab, R-E-H-A-B, is short for rehabilitation, when someone, for example, is recovering from an injury, they hurt their leg. They go through rehabilitation, where they become stronger and they do exercises. Sometimes that is just called rehab. We also use that word for someone who is an alcoholic and is going through a special program to stop drinking. Lab, L-A-B, is short for laboratory. Mag, M-A-G, is short for magazine. And celeb, C-E-L-E-B, is short for celebrity or a famous person. And the question is there a rule about when you can make words short? And the answer, unfortunately, is no. Certain words are abbreviated or shortened, but there isn't a rule. It just depends on how people use them. And so, unfortunately, it's one of those things that you just have to do a lot of listening and reading in order to know what these words mean. But those are some of the more common ones. Miki from Japan has a question about the use of the word apparent, A-P-P-A-R-E-N-T. Apparent has two different meanings. One of them is obvious or very clear. For example, it was apparent that my friend was angry. He was yelling, his face was red. Those are signs that he is angry. So it was obvious that he was angry because he was yelling or his face was red. That's one meaning of apparent. Apparent can also have a very different meaning, which is that something appears to be true, it seems to be true, but it may not be true. And this is sometimes used as an adverb, apparently. Someone will say, well, apparently there is no baseball game tonight. I was talking to my friend and he said that he didn't think the baseball game was tonight. Apparently means it might be true, but I'm not sure. But that's what I think. An expression that Miki asks about is an apparent suicide. Well, a suicide, S-U-I-C-I-D-E, is when someone kills themselves, when they take their own life on purpose. An apparent suicide, however, is not an obvious suicide. It's a death that looks like a suicide, but we're not sure. Was it an accident, or did the person actually want to fall off of the bridge and kill themselves? Well, that's the meaning of apparent. It has the second idea of something that appears to be true, it seems to be true, but it may not necessarily be true. So thank you, Miki, for that interesting question. Finally, we have a question from Santiago in Colombia. And Santiago wants to know what the word feature, F-E-A-T-U-R-E, means in the expression a feature presentation. Well, this is a phrase that you will see sometimes in a movie theater or when there is a movie on television. They'll say, this is a feature presentation. Basically, the feature presentation is the most important, the principal presentation. So there may be a small movie or short movie followed by a longer one. Well, the longer one may be called the feature presentation. Sometimes we just say the feature or the feature film. Same on television, when they have a feature film, they mean it's the most important one for that night, or We often use that expression just to mean a popular big movie on television. So thank you, Santiago, for that question. That's all we have time for. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. We'll see you next time on the English Cafe. ESL Podcast English Cafe is written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan. This podcast is copyright 2006 by the Center for Educational Development.